So today what we're going to talk about is what I call Christian secularism. Let's get on with it. The first two lectures have been aimed at secularism and what we might call the party of the world. Those lectures were about the secularism imposed from outside the church upon those inside the church. They were about the secularist removal of faith from the larger society. Many outside the church, especially cultural and intellectual elites, have argued for and desired the marginalization of Christianity in public life. I chose the topic of this third lecture with a great deal of trepidation, because it is here that I plan to comment on the church's response to secularism. Talking about the church in a lecture at one of the great centers of theological and pastoral education in the world is a fearful enterprise for a layman. Normally, I would not attempt it just because of simple prudence. When I was invited to speak on the topic of my choice to faculty and students in a doctoral program on philosophy, specifically the work of Thomas Aquinas, at the University of the University of St. Thomas, St. Thomas Aquinas, there was absolutely no chance I was going to take the bait offered by a friend on the faculty to talk about that famous philosopher. Yet, here we are, and I will take the risk of talking about the church to pastors and theologians and would-be pastors and theologians, because I think it is worth it to try to influence the influencers. Within the church, there is substantial tension around the question of how we should relate to the larger society. It is generally agreed that we should worship God, engage in missions and evangelism, offer the ministry of the word, and do works of mercy. What is much at stake is the degree to which the church should not only try to bring others to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ, but whether we should attempt to challenge the philosophical frameworks and the everyday operation of the larger society. Does the church have anything to say, then, about the many fields of life which we think about occurring in the world? Should the church attempt to affect so-called secular workings of the society? Is it true, as one Christian debate partner of mine recently claimed, that the activities of economics and a number of other fields, for example, are perfectly intelligible without any resort to theological reasoning, and thus we need not bring it to bear? He believes that we will help the world most by abandoning the public square for a secret Christianity as a way of chastening ourselves. I fear that he severely underestimates the degree to which many of the faithful would love to be told they must keep their faith secret. Or what about the law? Do we make some intrusive misstep when we attempt to affect the course of legislation in line with our view of righteousness? Would it be better to simply withdraw and be content to maintain certain standards just within our Christian community, within the church? Is it wrong to do political work that could result in a non-Christian being prohibited from obtaining an abortion? After all, they have not placed themselves in our moral context and do not pay allegiance to our God. Are we wrongly imposing ourselves upon them? Robert Audi, a very well-known and devout Christian scholar, has suggested as much. He has argued that Christians should only engage in political activity, including voting, when they can provide a fully secular motive for their choices. His view is rooted in civility. Audi is surely sensitive to those who complain that we wrongfully seek to enact rules which are inaccessible to them and thus result in aggravation and invasion. The point of view I intend to critique in this last lecture, then, is what I would call Christian secularism. What I mean by this term is the belief by many Christians that their faith should be private and that Christians should not seek to impact the public sphere as Christians with the content of the Christian faith. For a variety of reasons, I think Christian secularism is an inappropriate response to the world, and we'll use this lecture to explain why. One important source for this secularistic view of Christianity comes from the experience of the church in history. There is simply no way around the fact that the church has, at times, persecuted people, sold ministry for profit, operated as a political entity seemingly heedless of its primary duties, and committed other wrongs. I offer two items in mitigation of the record. First, the church gained such tremendous worldly power because it remained standing as the carrier of civilization when the Roman Empire fell, as the greatest standing source of cultural memory and know-how. It would be surprising if the church had not become a major political power. The power it gained was not always used badly, although the typical narrative dwells on the black marks. In fact, much of the greatness of Western culture relies heavily on the existence and influence of the church. Second, the church, considered broadly, went through a wrenching reformation, which helped transform the institution into its current healthier manifestations. The faithful church, Catholic, Protestant, and otherwise, is badly divided, but there is little question that it is a great advocate for freedom, human rights, and mercy today. Nevertheless, the mixed record of the church in positions of power tends to lead some to withdraw. The focus, they feel, must be inward. For them, the lesson is that when the church gains worldly power, it loses sight of its primary mission and succumbs to the logic of winning at all costs. The answer, then, is an isolated church with private believers. We will invite people into our circle, but we will not call upon the larger society to be righteous. The problem with this viewpoint, attractive as it may seem, is that it overdiagnoses the problem of the church's engagement in public affairs. It is true that when the church tried to operate like a government with authority over other governments, it arguably became just another political player, sort of the way Machiavelli saw it, asserting its interests and playing the game. But thanks to God's providence, the church has largely recovered from its time as something akin to a temporal nation state with a headquarters in Rome. Today, the church, including the part that resides in Rome, understands its role differently and better. Martin Luther decried the rule of souls by steel. He understood that the church is a persuader, not a coercer. Now the church in its various manifestations stands with him. We have abandoned the comprehensive church, a church which is simply coextensive with the political community, for the regenerate church, which consists of believers. And since I am standing in Southern Seminary, I would be remiss I don't want to fail to mention that the Baptists had a large part to play in achieving that transition. In fact, that was one of the signal achievements of the Baptists. This movement from the comprehensive church model to the regenerate church model has been accompanied by the development of the legal device of the separation of church and state. Secularists of all stripes mistake the separation of church and state for the irrelevance of the church, or the privatization of the church, or the marginalization of the church. The separation of church and state, correctly understood, is an institutional separation. It means that church leaders are not ministers of government, and clergy are not well-kept bureaucrats. It means indifferent citizens aren't taxed to support the church, and government has no right to determine church doctrine. This is the separation of church and state. Separation emphatically does not mean that the content and the action of the Christian faith is somehow inapplicable to the content of state policies or state action. Secularism is not equivalent to the separation of church and state. The idea that God should not come up in our community life together as diverse people goes well beyond mere boundaries between institutions. The separation of church and state is far superior to secularism because it maintains the independence of the church, avoids tempting the church with state power to coerce membership, and protects the church in its freedom to act as a conscience of the state, calling it to righteousness, persuading citizens and politicians. Secularism goes too far, and those who are zealous for secularism likewise go too far. They try to sanitize Christianity from the culture, even though it is clearly and demonstrably an organic source of much that is good. In addition, they end up truncating freedom of expression and belief by treating religious activities as harmful presences in the culture, which should be contained and isolated until we can outgrow them. This is the direction in which our politics and jurisprudence move. If we are not vigilant to maintain the rights and viability of our faith as part of truly the mainstream of American civilization, the current presidential administration has already announced a preference for the phrase freedom of worship over freedom of religion. Such a characterization is loaded with intent. Freedom of worship implies a role for faith which is limited to Sunday mornings and church buildings. Freedom of religion is a broader concept. Think about the word religare, that which binds us together. What has me especially troubled is that many Christians have bought into an isolationist perspective. I don't mean that they want to actively participate in attempting to minimize and marginalize the Christian faith, but they do buy into the logic that Christianity and its attendant morality is only for those of us who are sort of inside the tent. For example, many Christians might feel that they should raise their children not to have sex before marriage, but that it is some kind of wrongful imposition to take that view into the public square. Non-Christians are not bound by our scriptures, they often think. So how can we maintain that Christian morality should be normative for the broader society? The motives for accepting this argument and essentially being complicit in the project of secularization are basically pure. Those who think in this way are trying to be good neighbors, and they do not want to impose their faith on others. In addition, they disdain much of the combativeness they feel is evident in the way some conservative Christians engage the culture. In fact, I think that's a very large reason for why especially many young Christians tend to sort of disdain engagement in public affairs, because they're turned off by the tone of what they've seen from some Christian conservatives. They are happy to accept the engraved invitation from secularists to take their faith private. In fact, they may feel quite virtuous in doing so. Another purported reason to segregate Christianity from public life is that many perceive the existence of reason as something which operates independently of any religious influence. In essence, religious data are seen as irrelevant to the process of reasoning about the world and its affairs. This point of view is best exemplified by drawing a hard line between reason and revelation, like there's a big wall between the two and never the twain shall meet. If you buy into this framework, and Christians do in large numbers, then it is easy to feel cowed by the secularist and or atheist outrage at Christian participation in public affairs. They might say, how dare you bring some purely mystical position to bear on the public policies which will affect all of us? Many Christians are convinced by that line of argument. There are a couple of important answers we can give in response to the charge of introducing unfounded mysticism into a public square full of people who cannot and do not buy into it. First, the allegation that Christians try to bring revelation-based arguments into the public square with no accompanying evidence or so-called secular reasons is simply false. Surely the most famous Christian intervention in public policy has had to do with abortion. And what has been the dominant role in our discourse? Have we spent most of our time making a textual claim on the basis of Jeremiah 1 or Psalm 139? No. The most common rhetorical strategy has been to emphasize that the basic building block of the human person is the DNA, which is immediately present and which carries our distinctive attributes. Christians have also typically emphasized the life of the unborn child inside the womb. When my first child was in utero, Andrew, my wife was working as an OBGYN, and so she had pretty much unfettered access to an ultrasound machine. And I would come to pick her up from work, and she would just be back there in that darkened room, just moving that thing over her stomach and watching our child, on the ultrasound screen. And you could never tell me, I don't think you could tell any reasonable person, that the child did not have a life before he emerged from his mother. He clearly did. It was obvious to me that he did. How illogical is it to declare a child to be a person with full human rights upon exiting the birth canal and a non-person with no rights who can be killed as long as any part remains within the mother? These arguments, while motivated at least in part by a desire to honor God and the life he has made, are not arguments which can only be understood or embraced by a believer in the Christian scripture. The use of arguments and reasons which can be understood by a wide variety of people also characterizes other Christian ventures into politics. But even if we do venture into revelation-based arguments, for example, arguing for equality on the basis of Galatians 3:28, or adverting to God's endowment of every human with creation in his image, these arguments do resonate, and they do affect hearts and minds. Second, if the objection is to the imposition of Christian morality, then my question would be, well, which morality would you prefer that we use? Would it be better to employ an old Greco-Roman morality, which endorsed the gladiatorial games and infanticide? Or would it be better to operate on the terms of an early to mid-20th century Hitlerian Nietzschean morality, authorizing this sterilization and euthanasia of so-called life without value? What about the morality of Lenin, or Stalin's Soviet Union, or Mao's Cultural Revolution? Are those better models? Does their secularity somehow make them superior to what we would offer? The reality is that the state will adopt a moral stance, and it will impose it. What feels bad is not the source of the morality being used, but simply the fact that coercion is part of law. Regrettably, that's what law is. One definition of law is it's the part of morality that is made non-optional. This is why we have to be careful about the laws that we make, but we cannot abandon either law or morality. Christian morality is no unique imposition. The temptation is to believe that there is a scientific worldview that can win the day and destroy the need for contest. For that reason, let's consider what I referred to in the end of secularism as the knowledge situation. We can begin by thinking about science. Scientific knowledge, modern scientific knowledge, gained through the application of the scientific method, is the kind of knowledge we want if we can get it. I mean, this is true, right? I mean, if I can scientifically know just about anything, I would like to know it in that way. And so would you. I would like, for example, to know scientifically rather than through faith that the foundation of my house has been constructed in such a way as to successfully support the weight of the building. Because of the high value we place upon scientific knowledge, secularists have tried to build a case against Christianity and other religions that portrays us as the enemies of science. We as Christians supposedly hate science and want nothing more than to retard its development so that the world will be forced to remain in ignorance. and rely upon us for an extra scientific explanation of the phenomena we have yet to understand. They, of course, are the great guardians of science. This tactic goes deeper than the endless rehash and sensationalization of the Scopes trial. John Dewey thought that religion led people to look at a plant, which when consumed caused people to fall asleep, and say, well, it has a dormative quality. That's just the way it is. That's the way God made it. We're not curious to find out why. His critique isn't true to life. Christians are just as likely as non-Christians to be interested or uninterested, depending on the person's personality, in unlocking secrets of the natural world. But many Christians buy into this type of presentation, and they feel ashamed at the backwardness, the supposed backwardness of their fellow believers who oppose some purportedly good thing like embryonic stem cell research. Thus, we have Anne Rice recently fleeing the anti-science tendencies of the church. The mistake here, of course, is to confuse an ethical objection to some scientific undertaking with an objection to science itself. It should not be easy to make this kind of error. Confusing an ethical objection to embryonic stem cell research with an objection to science makes about as much sense as confusing an objection to driving on the sidewalk with an objection to automobiles. Science is great. Automobiles are great. We just object to some of the things you might do with them. This is the case with all instrumental goods. Science is instrumental. It can be put to good or ill use. It is not good in and of itself. Knowledge can make us stronger and better off. Regrettably, it can do the same thing for malevolent people of ill will. For those of you who enjoy comic books, the Fantastic Four provides a perfect example. Do you think you're going to hear about the Fantastic Four today? Provides a perfect example contrasting Reed Richards, Mr. Fantastic, the benevolent man of science thrust into heroics, versus the self-aggrandizing and evil Dr. Doom, right? Both rely on their scientific genius, but the uses of it vary widely depending on which man is working. It is not either man's scientific expertise which distinguishes him from the other. It is the moral choices each makes. To bring the discussion back out of the comics, Iran will likely someday have an atomic bomb. I mean, they may already. Will the use of science have been for the good? Scientific progress widens the range of possibilities, both for good and for potential disasters. It was inconceivable that actions of human beings could destroy human civilization on a global basis until our facility with science reached a certain point. We just lived a half century in the shadow of that possibility. It was called the Cold War. We need to recognize that science is not a cure-all for the problems of society. It will not make moral considerations irrelevant. Even the social sciences cannot do that because it is the most predictable and dependable type of knowledge available. We have had a tendency to overreach and to claim things for science that do not properly belong in its ambit. The limitations are immediately obvious. While science can tell us a great deal about forcing the natural world to give up its secrets and to allow us to manipulate the natural world, it is unable to tell us how to live. Consider these questions. Should we redistribute income? Should we use embryonic stem cells in research? Should we destroy suspect fetuses prior to birth? Should we clone human beings? Should we be pacifists? Should we aggressively seek out military conflict to further our interests? We could go on. Science won't answer those questions. The scientific has not replaced and cannot displace the moral. Thus, and this is a big point that I want to get across, secularists, even with their constant advertisement of their scientific virtue, do not have any advantage over Christians when it comes to moral reasoning. Indeed, they may be at a disadvantage. Moral reasoning has to have some foundation. Otherwise, we are simply expressing preferences and agreements. An atheist with whom I debated urged this version of morality upon me. All morality is relative depending on time and place. And so we talked and talked, and eventually we reached the point where the only possible move for him would be to admit that he believed an atrocity is only an atrocity if the people where it is committed agree that it is so. In other words, a very bad act could be simultaneously right or wrong depending on which part of the earth one's shoes happen to be gripping at the time. Purely secular reasoning about morals is difficult to support. For the best example, consider the matter of equality. Secularists tend to fully embrace the ideal of equality, but have a tremendously hard time making the case on any kind of empirical grounds. Martin Luther King Jr. argued for equality with resort to the Creator. For if we are equal, it is more likely before God than in any other way. The morality will come from somewhere. Morality with a Christian basis is highly desirable, whether many of us wish to acknowledge it or not. Christianity has modified the moral tradition of the West, and ultimately of most of the world, in important ways. The greatest of those modifications, in my view, are an appreciation of the need to limit human power because of the possibilities inherent in human sinfulness. The Christian appreciation for all human beings as bearers of God's image, who have innate dignity. Indeed, our tribalistic tendencies undercut this great contribution. And of course, Christians have also elevated mercy and charity as virtues. I mentioned Martin Luther King Jr. Consider this. Gandhi, who studied Jesus, Martin Luther King Jr., who's obviously a minister, and William Wilberforce, all pressed for human rights against nations we could call Christian, and they prevailed. Their victory was surely due in part to the Christian context to which they could appeal. How many such victories have we seen in communist China? I think about Tiananmen Square, where you have students who stand up, they make this moral stand. A friend of mine, a Chinese man, I can remember him literally weeping in a yogurt shop as he told me about the murder of some of his friends. Or what about the old Soviet Union or the Muslim world? A framework of Christian morality lends itself to appeals against persecution and enslavement. For that matter, Gandhi was able to convince the Christian British to let his people go. Yet, the inhumane Indian caste system has continued on for decades. Hindu is apparently not as accommodating when it comes to human rights. One thing of which I am certain is that the problem cannot be dispensed of by saying things like, you can't legislate morality. Such a statement is self-evidently untrue. It would be better to say that it is unwise to legislate morality, but that too is incorrect. While it is true that Thomas Aquinas argued against the repression of all vice through the instrument of law, because he thought that if you outlawed literally every vice, every human sin, people would not be able to stand it and might rebel, he did not argue for the development of law apart from morality. Indeed, he thought human law should simply be an extension of the natural law, which is a moral code hardwired into us by God. A gigantic portion of legislation has to do with morality. States affirm a vision of the good in both doing and not doing. Even the famed utilitarian political philosopher Jeremy Bentham identified law as the portion of morality which is non-optional. Thus, all morality is not law, but almost all law is morality. Neither can you dispense with the problem by arguing that there is reason on the one hand and revelation on the other. Looking at things that way, gives any type of reasoning that doesn't include God or conceals its first principles a big leg up that it doesn't deserve. It is clear that we are bound to accept scientific knowledge, really well-developed scientific knowledge, because it is empirical in nature and the results can be reproduced again and again. But beyond that, we are in the situation Alistair MacIntyre identified in his famed book, After Virtue. The moral outcomes you reach depend heavily on the premises with which you begin. The divide is not necessarily about religion so much as it is about the foundations of reason. There is such a thing as a secular theory of justice, a very famous one, that actually has little room for people actually getting what they deserve. You can only arrive at that kind of result if you begin from certain types of premises. Lots of different kinds of reason, including religious reasoning, compete with each other at a sub-scientific level. And they have to do that because science is not capable of resolving moral questions. Now, if we want to say that laws and public culture should simply emerge from our political consensus, that too is seriously problematic. I made the point in the last lecture that every Nazi could argue with integrity that he had simply been following the laws of his sovereign nation. Laws are not automatically filled with justice. They should be, but they aren't always. This, of course, was a point well noted by Augustine, Aquinas, Martin Luther King Jr. If you wish to hold the position that political consensus is ultimate, well, then prepare to excuse a parade of horribles, the likes of which you can scarcely imagine. We are stuck. There's no easy out, like separating religion from non-religion and just going on from there. The world system would prefer that you ignore what I've said and just go on believing that faith is essentially alien to reason. It says you can be rational and scientific, or you can be religious. But if you choose being religious, just kind of keep the noise down. Don't bother the rest of us. I appeal to you not to accept this disposition of the problem. Consider the following remarks from Richard John Neuhaus. Of all the institutions in society, only religion can invoke against the state a transcendent authority and have its invocation seconded by the people to whom a democratic state is presumably accountable. For the state to be secured from such challenge, religion must be redefined as a private, emphatically not public, phenomenon. In addition, because truly valueless existence is impossible for persons or societies, the state must displace religion as the generator and bearer of values. Therefore, it must screen out of public discourse and decision-making those values too closely associated with religion, lest public religion be given a source of moral authority other than the state itself. Neuhaus put his finger on exactly the issue for the church and for believers. Allow yourself to be privatized by the state, and you play directly into the world's hands. Go ahead and accept the invitation to be seen as purely mystical and interior. Accept the logic that says worldly activities operate independently on their own. They don't require the intrusion of Christian theology or values to be properly understood or pursued. Privatization blocks resistance from the church. Privatization blocks the prophetic call. And don't think for a moment that the world system will not happily use a church willing to sacrifice its focus on God for a set of values more comfortable for the state. When secularists and socialists have been able to own the church, they have delayed their plans for dismantling it. See the example of the Church of Sweden. They find an obedient church useful. It is my contention that we cannot accept this state of affairs. We cannot accept privatization or lapdog status. Though I have offered arguments already against a sharp secular-sacred divide, there's something far more important which must be considered. Archimedes is supposed to have said, "Give me a lever long enough and a fulcrum on which to place it, and I shall move the world." The fulcrum and lever which the church uses to move the world is the resurrection of Christ. The resurrection of Christ as an event that occurred in time and space and history. As I talk about this, I think about the best Easter sermon I ever heard. Now listen, it's a layman talking, okay? It didn't have any great hooks like, "It feels like Friday, but Sunday's coming." The sermon wasn't delivered with a lot of panache, but it struck a very deep chord within me. The pastor who preached that sermon spent about 40 minutes reviewing the evidence for the resurrection of Christ. To me, that was a great Easter Sunday sermon. It was less about generating an emotional response than it was a statement about the deepest realities, the truths that underlie our existence, way beyond some one moment where we pray the prayer, or as one Texas pastor in my mind offensively puts it, do the deal. You need to do the deal. The simple sermon was the kind to prompt people to realize that if the resurrection of Christ really happened, then it changes everything. The change is not just for me, not just for my particular tribe. It is a triumphant strike against the world, for the world. I think about my own faith journey. I became a Christian through the ministry of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship at Florida State University toward the end of the 80s. My faith started as what I refer to as a tribal faith. I met people who were Christians, and sort of like Dancing with Wolves, right? You know, the proud white soldier is taken in by the Indians and learns their ways. That was me with the Christians, right? And I came to admire them. And so I wanted to adopt their practices and their attitudes as my own. This was less about having a well-considered faith in Christ as it was about finding a group with which I wanted to identify. And so at that point, I had what I'd call a tribal faith. And then I began to have what I'd call a therapeutic faith. I looked at relationship with God as kind of a way to help me get through life. And so my faith floated along on emotion. But this faith I'm describing did not have a strong foundation. I've seen too many people like that who, you know, something goes against them and they're done. It was not until the woman who would years later become my wife urged me to better understand the foundations of the Christian faith that I began to see how much rests upon the resurrection of Christ. I began to realize that the Bible might be more than just the favorite purportedly magic book that people in the West or in America generally like better than purportedly magic books from other lands. It could actually contain a record of events. The resurrection of Christ may have actually happened in time and space and history. I came to see this. And once I began to believe that, I had a faith that could not easily be shaken. And I came to see that the resurrection of Christ is like the noise of the Big Bang that is said to still be detectable through radio telescopes as background static. The event reverberates through history with force and power. When I became convinced of the resurrection of Christ, I ceased being a tribal Christian or a transient psycho-emotional tourist. Instead, I gained a real faith in the Son of God who could rightfully claim to be king. In Acts 17, when Paul goes to the Areopagus to speak with the men of Athens, he enters into a debating society, which makes a good analog for the world of today. Just like us, they offer competing versions of morality launched from different foundations and premises, and nothing ever really gets resolved. The participants prefer to amuse themselves through their own rhetorical skill, their ability to debate. But what I see happening in that native is that Paul cuts through all of that, just like Alexander the Great slicing through the Gordian knot, the knot that couldn't be untied. You know, he slices through it with an uncommonly sharp blade. He takes note of the statue to an unknown god and seizes the moment to tell the Athenian philosophers who God is. Being then the children of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man. Therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all people everywhere should repent, because he has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead. I began the end of secularism with a little story about a philosopher who keeps dreaming about this response that beats all comers. You know, in his dream, there are just countless great minds from history, and they're all lining up to talk to him. And they kind of present their case, and he says one sentence and just sends them away. And the problem is he can never remember in the dream what he said, right? And so it's driving him insane. He goes to a psychologist. You know, they try to hypnotize him. They can't get it out. So the psychologist tells him, you know, you have to will yourself to wake up at that moment and write it down. And, you know, you'll probably fall back asleep, but just do it. So he has the dream. He wakes up. He scribbles something down on the nightstand. He falls back asleep. And when he wakes up the next morning, he's trembling. I mean, he cannot wait to check and see what it says. And so he looks, and his pad says, "Well, that's what you say." Okay. Up until the very end of that passage I just read from Acts, the men of Athens could simply reply to Paul, "Well, that's what you say." And that is the answer to Islam. "Well, that's what Muhammad said." It is the answer to Mormonism. "Well, that's what Joseph Smith said." But it cannot be the final answer to Paul, who points to the resurrection of Christ as proof that what he says about God is true. If indeed there is this man who claimed to be the Son of God and who then was killed in a public spectacle, only to then be seen by many witnesses and not to leave a corpse, that would demand attention. If you think it really happened, then the things that man had to say take on an urgency and an importance that far surpasses anything else this world has ever seen. And there is certainly evidence to support the event. Of course, read the Gospels, read Acts, look at N.T. Wright's The Resurrection of the Son of God, or Gary Habermas's Did the Resurrection Really Happen? As Christians, we do not need to play the game the world wants us to play. It wants us to pretend that Christianity is just like any other religion. It wants us to buy into false divides like reason versus revelation. They apply to many religions, but not so much to Christianity. The resurrection of Christ was an event on earth. It's as real to me, just looking back at history, as Caesar crossing the Rubicon. It happened in the world, and it affects the world. And so if Christ is the only religious figure to be able to make a plausible claim to having triumphed over death, not just in some ethereal sense, well, he lives on in our hearts, but in reality, the only reality that we know, this world, his resurrection collapses the distance between Jewish and Christian revelation and the realm of reason, and gives the moral teaching of the church much stronger authority than the world believes it has. The resurrection of Jesus Christ is a bridge between reason and revelation. Through him, we can know something of God. God has made this possible for us. This is what Paul is saying to the men of Athens. This is what the church must say to the world. The existence of this bridge between Christian revelation and reason provides a real foundation for ethics beyond mere assertion. Most important, of course, is that the resurrection provides us with a foundation for hope, a hope for all the world, a hope that the existence and meaning of Christianity will go on long past the death of our solar system. Who is this man, Jesus? I think the world tends to understand him the way Ernest Hemingway did in his short play, Today is Friday. It is not well known among his works, but it does a good job of illustrating how many people see Jesus. The play opens with three Roman soldiers in a bar, drinking away the stresses of a long, brutal day of torture, of crucifixion. and a man identified only as the third soldier is sick. He's sick and he's rueful. He complains that something is wrong with his stomach. It's clear that something he's done that day has just kind of gotten to him. And the second soldier tries to make him feel better by minimizing what has happened and by running down the victim as nobody special. But the first soldier refuses to go along, even though his peer mocks the crucified man by saying it was obvious he was a poser who clearly wasn't anything special. You know, he couldn't even come down off that cross. The first responds, he didn't want to come down from the cross. That wasn't his play. He goes on to talk about Jesus in a somewhat tragic and admiring fashion. This is the part that always stays with me from that little play. First soldier says, he was pretty good in there today. In Hemingway's vision, Jesus is the bad conscience of the world, the mistreated and martyred man of peace, but not its savior. We may realize they are sinners, these Romans, but there is no hope in these men drinking to get rid of their ugly memories after a day of torture. The haunting and memorable line is repeated throughout the scene. He was pretty good in there today. In contrast, I often think about a conversation Frederick Buechner, the son of a man who committed suicide, had with his mother when she asked him in her later years, "Do you really think anything happens after you die?" He was surprised because she usually didn't want to talk about death. He responded loudly against her usual deaf, which he couldn't tell was either real or pretended. "Yes," he said he believed, "something happens." Buechner ended up writing his mother a letter because he didn't feel he could get what he wanted to say past her deafness and her general fear of discussing spiritual matters. In his letter, he reasoned with her about the mind of God and about our intuitions about eternity. But the part that really struck me, the part that really stayed behind, was this, his conclusion. And lastly, he wrote her, "I believe that what happens to us after we die is that we aren't dead forever because Jesus said so." Jesus said so. The strength of his statement lies in the resurrection. Jesus is a person to be believed because he is unique in all the world's history. He is the one who rose bodily from the dead and demonstrated that he is the King of Kings and the one true Lord. He is the one who speaks with authority. Announcing Christ as King sets off a domino reaction throughout our existence. He is the Lord of our lives, and thus we are bound to follow him. He is the Lord of creation. Every power, every kingdom, every dominion on earth can only pretend to the power that is rightfully his. The ones who have tried to raise up an image in his place, some other God-man, they rise, fall, and fade in significance, like the ruler Ozymandias, who was portrayed by Percy Shelley in verse. His ruined, sneering visage lies on the ground, separated from two vast and trunkless legs of stone, though an inscription testifies to his greatness. "Look upon my works, ye mighty, and despair. There is no evidence of it to be seen in the wasteland." Christ's rule is the only one that will endure forever. All of this springs forth from the resurrection. It affects our lives, our morals, our politics, and our understanding of human beings. In a section of The Resurrection of the Son of God, provocatively titled Resurrection and World Leadership, N.T. Wright explained that the early Christians used the phrase Son of God to describe Jesus, both knowing that pagan emperors had applied it to themselves and intending to confront them with the world's true Lord. Calling Jesus the Son of God in this sense demonstrated the determination of early Christians to to prevent themselves from being understood as a private cult, a sect, a mystery religion. What began as an absurd challenge toward Rome, launched by a tiny group of nobodies, became so serious that within a couple of generations, the might of Rome was trying and failing to stamp it out. Wright also pointed out that what makes the resurrection so powerful is that it was a physical triumph over death. Christ did not merely die and go to heaven. This is critical. To quote Wright again, death is the ultimate weapon of the tyrant. Resurrection does not make a covenant with death, it overthrows it. The resurrection, in the full Jewish and early Christian sense, is the ultimate affirmation that creation matters, that embodied human beings matter. Part of what makes Christianity so dangerous is the political meaning of the event. Governments of the world have less to fear of those who argue for Christ's teachings unaccompanied by his resurrection and lordship. Christ is risen, he is Lord, and his kingdom is one to be reckoned with, not only by Christians, but by the whole world. Thank you.
Now and have time for questions. Please come to the microphone if you have a question.
I'm going to stay by the microphone this time because they told me all my wandering away is messing up the audio, so I'm going to stick here.
The question was asked yesterday, how do you see this happening practically?
Yes.
So I would pose the same question. I understand.
Yeah.
I understood the lecture, and just on a day-to-day level, how does that happen?
How do we confront the world with a resurrection? Is that what you mean? How do we...
person at a time is what it is?
No, I guess what I would say is, first of all, I mean, the first part of the project from my perspective is to kill this movement in the church to withdraw. I mean, you know, each person will see their role differently, but a big part of what I see is a desire to withdraw, to pull back, And I think it will be damaging to the culture, and I think it's against our mandate. So I'm trying to combat that. And of course, I mean, look at what Christians have done in politics. A lot of it hasn't worked out that well. We need to keep trying. We need to do better. You know, I mean, I guess what I'm bringing to you is not so much a blueprint for how do we go forward, as much as I'm kind of giving a critique against the secular viewpoint that I think often paralyzes us.
So it's about being equipped.
Exactly, yes, sir. Right.
Giving people
that ability. Yes. Well, and trying to give confidence, you know, not to feel like that you are the unreasonable person, you know, they are all scientific and civilized, and here you are some knuckle-dragging clod, you know, bringing your retrograde religion into the public square. I'm trying to combat that whole presentation of things.
I was reading the Kitzmiller case this morning in connection to church-state relations class, mm-hmm. and, you know, it seems that the courts
That was the ID case, right?
The ID case, yeah. Kitzmiller, Dover, where the guy said, look, ID's not science, and besides, I know what you're up to. You're trying to slip some creationism in here. And it seems again and again, in these religious cases, the court is hermetically sealing
yes.
the schools and so forth, the public. Now there's a California case where you can't even have a, whatever it was, Christian Legal Society chapter on campus in a mm-hmm. state school. Mm-hmm. How in the world, if they're so determined to absolutely insulate the public square from Christian influence, how do we proceed?
Well, that again is part of why I conduct this critique of secularism, to show that it's not as secure as it thinks it is, you know, philosophically and otherwise. I'm very concerned about what you just talked about, because what I perceive in a whole series of legal cases, not only really more to do with things like homosexuality than with ID, although the same thing applies there, is that the court is beginning to try to, like, give its own kind of narrow definition of what reason is. And it definitely excludes any religious influence. And what I mean by that in particular, when I was in law school, which is not so long ago, well, there's a standard that courts use, okay? And when evaluating the action of a state, the federal court will say, we're using a rational basis standard, right? Just what they do has to be rational, okay? And when I was in school, the way that was taught to us was that the court has to be really deferential about what is rational. Because you can, you know, you can justify things, and people disagree, but you can justify things. And so she said, you know, the court won't find something irrational unless a state does something as ridiculous as saying that everybody has to jump around with one green sock on Tuesdays. You know, that was violating the rational basis standard. And now the court is using that same standard, and they're saying that you can find no justification. You can find no justification for marriage as a heterosexual arrangement. You know, I certainly agree that there are people who can find objections to that, who can critique that point of view, but they certainly can't say there's no justification for heterosexual marriage. You know, so if they're going to draw in the kind of the confines of reason so strictly that basically it just sort of suits their own worldview, then we have some really tough sledding.
Exactly. Let me pitch you one more case, sure. And I've got to check out. There's a case years ago after Houdini died, and he lured a bunch of people into spiritualism with, you know, seances and things that go bump in the night. And one guy changed his entire will to give the money to the Spiritualist Society, and the daughters contested the will, saying, wait a second, it says being of sound mind. Anyone who would buy that is not of sound mind, so give us the money. And the judge said, no, that's within the pale of, even though it may be wacky. And so that's to your point, that it has
tightened up. That's exactly right. Yeah. That's and, you know, and there's a whole line of cases where if courts have, let's say, for example, two different kinds of Baptist churches or two factions within a Baptist church kind of arguing about things, very often the court would just refuse to enter into that altogether. That very deferential, you know, well, how can we say that we know better than you, right? Because really what they're supposed to do is they're supposed to be experts in the law. There's nothing about going to law school, and I know because I went, that makes you a great philosopher, right? You know, or some kind of enlightened human being more capable of making basic moral decisions better than anybody else. And yet they have begun to kind of adopt that role.
This question is a little bit, beyond, okay, so we know we need to get into the public square, agreed with that. So as Christians talking about and instructing church members and our family in Christ about what laws we should get behind and how to understand that, because obviously there's, in conservative evangelicalism, pro-life. But then you'd have people like Jim Wallace.
Sure.
Oh, we need to do economics, you know, and bring the Bible to bear on that. So how do we gauge which is correct to get behind, which is not?
Well, I mean, a lot of that kind of thing is just basically prudence, as opposed to any scriptural command. But you know, one of the things I would say, here's a place where I disagree with somebody like Jim Wallace. Okay, in my view, he would say, well, if you want to oppose abortion, then you had also better be ready to sign on for this, you know, giant set of social programs to make up for the fact that you're prohibiting abortion. And I think it's good. I think it's good that we would do that, but I do not think that the one position entails the other, right? If you say that abortion is wrong, well, the reason we're saying it's wrong is because the evil is the evil is the evil, right? It's wrong to kill somebody. Okay, if I want to say it's wrong to kill somebody, it doesn't mean I have to erect this giant welfare state to go along with it. So that's the kind of disagreement that I have with him. But in terms of how Christians are going to argue differently about things, Christians are going to have different views about things like the Iraq War. And I'm not going to sit here and say I'm qualified to say which one is right. But it pleases me. I think it is healthy for the democracy. I think it's healthy for our culture if people who are Christians feel that they need to go ahead and bring that, right, and be in the middle of the discussion process and be kind of leavening the lump. So I'm not going to kind of stand up here and give you my contract for America or whatever else, but I do think that we have a mandate to be out there and be involved. Yes, sir.
Yes.
Three in a row.
Yeah. So while there's – what do you say to someone that says, okay, I understand why you're wanting to legislate your kind of morality and against some vices and stuff, which is true, which we need to do that. And I agree, which is true, which I'm about to say is – and it's morning, so I have a hard time talking because I'm not a morning guy. But we don't – I don't. If my kids are going to be in public school, if I ever get a wife and have children,
God willing,
yeah, it would have. She would have to do something grievous against God for him to do that to her. But I don't want my kids, if they're going to be in public school, if they will be in public school, if I have kids, lots of hypotheticals, to be taught evolution. You know.
Okay.
And I think any Christian of sane mind would say we do not want our children taught this atheistic worldview of evolution, and probably you as well. I'm just supposing that. So how would you answer someone with saying, well, wait a second, that's not a vice, that's not a moral dilemma, you're just trying to limit science?
Yeah. My view on that, I hopefully it won't get me in trouble, but I'll have to tell you, I I don't think that it's a reasonable strategy for us to say that the public schools should not talk about evolution. I would be very disturbed if the public schools were to kind of push evolution in its broadest implications. You know, well, we think that this is true, and therefore, you know, the world is entirely purposeless and meaningless, and there is no God. You know, I mean, just the whole package. In fact, there are some legal scholars who say that if the schools do it in that way, that they are in fact violating the separation of church and state. Some very mainstream, well thought of scholars. What I think we should do, both in the public schools and even in our Christian schools, is say, look, here it is. This is evolution. This is the dominant paradigm. You know, there's some evidence for this. We don't know for sure if it's true. There's a ways to go. There are a number of critiques of it that are out there. Let's talk about what those are. What are some of the weaknesses? But I don't think that we run from it. I think we go ahead and lay it out there and deal with it. Because if we just avoid it entirely, I think then it looks like we're insecure and we're unable to cope with the information.
You linked Christian secularist mindset with a kind of ignorance or a feeling of ignorance. Would you also link it to a fear of persecution?
I don't know about that. I think that I guess what I would say is, first of all, I think a lot of Christian secularists do have good motives. They believe they're doing the right thing. They're being hospitable within the culture, not to kind of confront on certain issues. I don't think it's so much fear of persecution as much as fear of being made fun of, fear of being held in low esteem. I think that, for instance, there are some parts of the church, kind of in the main line, like maybe sort of the liberal Episcopal church, where they have strayed so far from anything like Christian orthodoxy that all they have left is, well, what's the next commandment we can break and therefore be novel and get in the newspaper, right? You know, I mean, okay, we've done the female clergy, now let's do gay clergy, now let's do female gay clergy, you know, I mean, that's all that's left for them, right? So I think there's some of that. I think also there's a huge desire in the kind of the progressive secularist world to find voices like ours to be supportive of them. So without calling out any particular Christian scholars, some of whom are my friends, I would say that sometimes a Christian scholar will kind of edge out there and kind of make some comments, you know, critical of sort of conservative Christians, and they get like a nice glow of applause from, you know, the establishment media or from progressives. So then they step out a little more and they get some more plaudits, and maybe they get a nice, you know, speaking engagement at a place they never would get invited to speak. And, you know, just it's kind of self-reinforcing. Sometimes there's a worldly logic to moving away from the message. I mean, the gospel, sometimes we call it a scandal, right? And sometimes people want to just get away from that scandal and feel that sort of that strange new respect that you get when you walk away.
Anyone else?
I don't know. I guess I had a question about a strategy. Like, would we want to go after the basis of secular thought, secular philosophy? And if so, what is that basis? Or would we want to just flat preach the gospel, or both?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, whenever people ask either or questions, I always wonder, well, why do we have to have an either or an or? I mean, you take a preacher like James McDonald, okay? I name him because my wife loved James McDonald, and he's always echoing throughout my house. he's a fantastic preacher, a fantastic proclaimer of the word. That's his gift. But I think there are others among us who have a gift to try to look at something like secularism and try to undermine it, try to kind of bring them back to earth, try to preserve some real estate for Christians to act in politics. And that's the part to which I feel called. I mean, when John Somerville at University of Florida talked about that, you know, why aren't there any scholars of secularism? You know, there's plenty of critical scholars of religion. Why aren't there any studying secularism? Who's studying the secularists? You know, who's documenting their activities, like Jane Goodall studying the chimpanzees or something? I thought, you know, hey, that's what I'm going to do, right? So that's kind of the tack I'm taking, and, you know, you'll find some other creative ways to do it.
We want to thank you once again and appreciate having you here on our campus.
Thank you.